Welcome back, everybody, for our second panel discussion, which has the rather long title of Bringing the Balkans Westward. Should translators of so-called small languages aim to be invisible or consider themselves a second author? A contentious issue, I'm sure. And to lead the discussion, I'm very pleased to welcome Tina Pribicevic-Zoric, who is herself a literary translator and has also worked as an interpreter. I'll pass over to you, Christina.
So we're going to talk about literary translation today. And before I introduce the panel, I thought I would mention the following, that according to the latest figures, translated books in America account for 3% of all published books. When it comes to literary translation, that is close to 0.7%. I think the figures are more or less the same for Britain. I mention this because you can then imagine how difficult it is to translate and get published works from so-called smaller languages. With us today is a panel of people who can tell you much more about those problems and about generally the issues of translation when it comes to novels and poetry. We have two poets with us. We have Stephen Watts, who is a poet, a translator, and editor, and who also organized a wonderful conference in London called Tongues in the City, which focused on the different languages in which people write in London. We have Melwood Jalan, poet, also translator, and also the co-founder of an international poetry magazine called Core. We have John Hodgson, who is a translator from Albanian into English. He is one of only a handful, and I think that's half a hand, of people who work, translators, who work directly from Albanian into English. I think there are only two, and if I'm right, they're both in this room. And we have Christopher Buxton, who is a writer, a translator of classical and modern Bulgarian literature and poetry, and who is the new recipient of an award from the Bulgarian Ministry of Culture for helping to promote Bulgarian culture in Britain. So it's quite an extraordinary pleasure to be able to sit with these people. I've thought a lot about translation, and I have so many questions that I don't really know where to start. One of the issues that is very often mentioned when discussing translation is it an art or is it a craft? So I thought I might start by asking Christopher Buxton, as both a published writer of novels and a translator, whether when he is translating, whether he thinks to himself, oh, I wouldn't have written it this way, I would have written it in a different way, and whether it's hard for him to take off his writer's cap when translating another writer. Christopher.
Okay. I think that I've been involved in translation pretty much from the moment I became a teacher of English as a foreign language and started. It's a tremendous privilege being an English person to be able to do this, travelling around the world, being looked after tremendously well by a series of countries, and from the ground, learning the language, learning first of all how to shop, then beginning to mingle, beginning to make my host feel that they didn't always have to speak in English to me, beginning to understand jokes, even to begin to pretend to understand them, and then actually do understand them. And my work as a novelist, since I've been involved in Bulgaria since 1977, when I first went there, knowing virtually nothing about this country at the other end of Europe, the southeast corner of Europe, was to convey as a novelist the Bulgarian experience, and particularly the Bulgarian experience when it comes into direct contact with the other, the non-Bulgarian, meetings between Westerners and Bulgarians and Easterners and Bulgarians and so on and so forth. At the same time, I was learning the language on the street, in the bars, but also through reading, and I became intensely aware of the lack of knowledge in this country of Bulgarian literature and what a great literature it is. And so I don't feel a great disassociation between my work as a writer of imaginative fiction and my job as a translator, except that I really want to convey truly what the writer has said, but at the same time to make it accessible and in a language that English people will relate to and understand. And I think perhaps that might have a bearing on the kinds of books that I choose to translate as well, and particularly the kind of poetry that I choose to translate.
What kind of poetry is that?
Poetry which has got strong physical images, as opposed to being very abstract. Bulgarian poetry, a bit like the cliche about Eskimos and snow, Bulgarian poetry has so many words meaning grief, sorrow, which kind of goes with the stereotype of Bulgarians, which I think Georgi Gospodinov mentions in his book, The Physics of Sorrow, that Bulgaria is statistically the most mournful country in Europe, but though has the greatest sense of humour, which is very close to the English sense of humour. If I can just finish with a joke which kind of reflects on this, the self-deprecation. Todor Zhivkov, who was the president of Bulgaria, longest-serving president who survived from the death of Stalin all the way through to the fall of communism in 1989, was generally looked down on by Bulgarian people, but he was the longest-surviving prime minister president in the communist world, and there had to be a reason for this. Anyway, here's the joke. Brezhnev, Todor Zhivkov, and various other communist prime ministers and presidents are invited by Jimmy Carter to the White House for a slap-up meal. And of course, the Americans being the Americans, they want to impress their communist guests, so every coffee cup has got a golden spoon. Our man, Todor Zhivkov, looking right, left, left and right, waiting for his chance, picks up the golden spoon and puts it in his pocket. However, he has reckoned without Brezhnev. Brezhnev leans back at some opportune moment and he says to President Carter, he says, President Carter, he says, I don't know if you knew this, but I was brought up in a circus milieu, and I know some magic tricks. And I'm going to show you one. I'm going to take this golden spoon here, and I'm going to put it in my pocket. I'm going to say some Russian words, and I'm going to pick into Todor Zhivkov's pocket. Which kind of typifies in the sense of Bulgarian self-deprecation. Which is translatable.
Okay. It's very hard to follow that. Let's stick with languages for a bit. Mevlut, you translate Turkish poetry into English, but you also translate English into Turkish. And I'm wondering whether there's a difference for you when you're going in one way or in the other. Is one easier, harder, not?
I think Turkish is not being the part of the European languages. I think that is the difficult part. So also cultural differences as well, you have to focus on, as you said, the Bulgarians, probably Turks are the same, you know, the the sadness, you have more than one word to express one feeling. It's the same in English, but however, some of the words you have in Turkish, you don't have the equivalent in English. Mm. So it's hard to catch, in that sense, Turkish is a disadvantage compared to other European languages. I think I see the translator's role is kind of a recreation in another languages. That reminds me, I always like the fables, the Mulla Nasreddin, probably most people knew of him. One day his neighbors hears a noise coming from his house. He says, knocks his door, what's wrong, what happened? Oh, he says, my clock fell off the stairs. How comes a clock, you know, makes such a sound? He says, I was in it. So, I think translators, they've got to be in the game, at the center. Probably that's why translators usually have the famous phrase, translators are traitors. But I think they are facilitators, I think, not the traitors. I think they are the bridge builders, architects between the cultures, I think. That's why I think early on, all the role of translators kept coming up. And as we know, yeah, the effects of translations to Renaissance and others throughout the history, I mean, it's very obvious.
Yeah. All right, that leads me to ask another poet, Stephen Watts, who co-translates from more languages than you might believe, as varied as Farsi, Arabic, Slovene, and Romanian. And what may be interesting for people to hear is about the process of co-translating, and as far as I know, you do co-translate poetry with other poets. Is that right?
Yeah, I co-translate with other poets and with other translators in quite a wide range of ways. I'm not sure how to answer your question. I want to go back to a question you sent out earlier. Who do you translate for, the author or the reader?
Okay, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. Because it's relevant, I think. I translate for the poetry, not for the author or the reader, because unless I'm translating for the poetry, I cannot translate for the author or the reader. And as a co-translator, in this instance, co-translation means I usually don't speak the language I'm co-translating from. I mean, people use co-translation when there are two translators who do understand both languages. I'm talking about a language that I don't understand. I don't speak Farsi, I don't speak Romanian. But I do translate from both languages with poets who are mother tongue in those languages. And the reason I do that, in the case of Farsi, because there are a number of fantastic Iranian poets living in London who, until recently, certainly 20 years ago, had no one translating at all, because contemporary Persian poetry just was almost not translated. And in the case of Romanian, which is more germane to what we're thinking about today, I'd read a lot of Romanian poetry in translation since about 1975. I had certain Romanian poets who I'd loved in translation, going back to Vlada or Argeza particularly. But why I started translating Romanian poetry was because I met in Slovenia, as a matter of fact, at a writers and translators gathering. And I think that's something very important to mention, because there, for me, gatherings of poets and translators together at festivals or at just meetings over a few days is an essential thing. It really is vital for the energy of translation, for me anyway. So I met a poet called Claudiu Comartin, who's from Bucharest. He's a young poet, he's probably about 25 then. It's a nice little story, because he arrived in Ljubljana, and all my Slovenian friends were tremendously busy, and they said, because I knew Liana quite well at that time, can you show Claudio around? So we had a great time just walking around the streets and talking to each other. And then something sort of gels. You feel some... It's a difficult thing to say this, but for me, as a poet, I it's not the surface of the language, it's the sort of aura language underneath. And that sounds like a sort of odd mystical term, but it damn well isn't. It's a real concrete term. There's this underneath of language from which your poetry emerges. And if I meet a poet who I think, or who thinks of me, that there is a sort of similarity, or that we're both plunging down into the same oral language, even though the actual surface language is completely different, then the possibilities of translating are really there. And if I feel that, then I want to be open to the possibilities of translating. So I've translated Claudio's poetry with him and vice versa, but also we've translated some Romanian poets who we both love, like Gelu Maun. Actually, particularly some of the poets such as Gelu Maun, who until very recently hadn't been so widely translated. And that's another thing that matters to me as a poet. I'm just, ever since I started writing poetry 40 years ago, just assumed there are wonderful poets in every language. And many of them are hidden because many of them are not translated into English. Many of them are hidden because they're not actually that well known in their own language areas necessarily as well. So I've always wanted to try and work translating less well-known poets who somehow I feel I love and who the person I'm working with also loves.
That's a good beginning to discussing how one chooses also whom one translates. John has translated 4 or 5 books by Ismail Kadouria. And many of his books, Kadouria's, have a historical context. There's the Three Arched Bridge, I think, which takes place in the 14th century. So when translating something that has a historical context, how does a translator approach getting that imagery into, in our case, English?
Well, this rather links, I think, with what links to what we were saying this morning about time travel and geographical travel, because this particular novel is set in the medieval Albanian world, which has certain points of contact with the medieval world elsewhere in Europe. So you sink into that, but it also, like so much of Kadouria's work, has a lot of Ottoman Empire, a lot of Turkey. So you're doing a rather oriental journey at the same time, and this is, I think, it's imaginatively sinking into it, and there's often a question of how far you can take this. And how far you can go with your specialized vocabulary, and here I think you've got to think of the reader. I was very struck by what you said about translating the poetry and translating the work. It's not the author or the reader, and this wonderful idea of an Ur language seething away under there. but I think with a novel. I very much think of the reader, and then there comes the question of which reader, because different readers can be expected to bring different levels of background awareness and knowledge of Albania, because an Albanian novel will be read by people who are interested in Albania, and they can be assumed to know quite a bit about it. However, there's a more interesting, more elusive class of reader of people who are keeping up with interesting books from around the world. And they're very, very hard to pin down and find. My partner was once at some little social gathering, and he met a dentist from Marylebone. And this dentist from Marylebone said, "I'm reading Ismail Kadare." So now when I am translating, I think, how will this dentist will he get this work?
Okay. Let's take that and let's think region. It's very hard to translate some regional concepts, words, etc., into English. But in today's day and age, you have Western concepts moving into the Balkans, into Turkey as well, through television programs, internet. So I presume that in Turkey you will have seen all sorts of American comedies and whatever. And therefore, if you're reading in Turkish a book which refers to a hamburger, your Turkish reader won't have to have a Turkish equivalent necessarily for the word hamburger, because, well, maybe I'm wrong, but I would assume that such a word might be known in Europe generally. Whereas, when translating from Turkish into English, if you want to explain that your character is eating burek, you might have to explain. You might choose not to, but you might have to. So my question is, how hard is it when you're translating from Turkish into English to convey very Turkish concepts? And what do you do? How do you handle it?
Well, it's hard. As you know, the Turkey as a culturally as well as, well, not so much probably politically, is at the crossroads. So let me start saying, first time when I came to this country, I knew nothing of, I knew a few words, I could ask for water. And then I start watching Benny Hill. Who would remember Benny Hill?
Very much loved on the Balkans.
Oh, yes. Initially, when I watched the programs, because when I look around, people, they laugh. I was wondering why they are laughing. To me, it's a Dutch. Then gradually, a few years later, now I laugh with them. But not 100%, still 95%. So it takes time to transfer, render from one culture to another. You will get always that nuances, you see. You won't get the same concept in another language. For example, if I say to you are entering my eye, what does that mean? What I meant really is, well done, you did well. So that sort of, it's language of phrases. It's both, I mean, it's raining cats and dogs. In Turkish, you don't, I mean, to me it's nonsense. You don't see cats and dogs rain from coming from the sky. So it is hard, especially like ours. I mean, you talked about Oriental. I mean, you have that concepts of Oriental concepts in the Western eye. However, nowadays, as you said, because of the media, now in the, you have this global village, even global neighborhood, now much more closer culturally. For example, if we have the equivalence of hamburger in Turkish, we call it köfte or pizza with the, you know, the lahmacun with the thin base. But then again, because of the dominant image you get from the media, always the pizza comes to mind. But you have the equivalent there as well.
So what do you do? Do you choose? If you're translating, let's say, an American writer who is describing in English, from English into Turkish, who's describing a hamburger, do you give the Turkish equivalent, or do you say hamburger?
I think if I use my poetical license, I would use the Turkish equivalent.
Okay.
Because that makes more sense.
Yes.
Fair enough.
Meaningful to our Turkish reader.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, it's not far off from the original either. Because it's just there.
Well, let me ask Christopher, you've translated so much. how do you choose the writer or poet that, I know it's a hard question, but how do you choose the writer or poet that you decide to translate, A, and B, how faithful do you feel that you have to be to the original text when translating?
Right, I think, first of all, starts with a tremendous enthusiasm. I read something and I think, yes, this will mean something to an English reader. I've been particularly recently, I mean, there's a tremendous diaspora now, Bulgarian diaspora, and there are more and more writers who are writing in Bulgarian, but not writing in Bulgaria. They're writing in New Zealand or Canada. And I very often get requests for translation to translate their work. It's something within me. I read something. I think this book is an absolute masterpiece. It ought to be translated. And I just translate 30 pages. There's a particular book which I think which will become a modern classic. It's called The Heights by Milin Ruskov. And it is, along with Alec, Milin is somebody who's looking at recent history. Bulgarian history is very important to Bulgarians, partly because if we ignore the Middle Ages, which is a fascinating area, but nevertheless, most Bulgarians do ignore the Middle Ages, and remember 500 years, this is like a litany, 500 years of
us.
of <them. laughs> of course, during communism, the mythology that was sort of created around Alex writing about partisans, the communist partisans, but the mythology that was written about the forerunners of the partisans, the brigands that infested the mountains in Bulgaria. Anyway, Milin Ruskov wrote this book, which he created two archetypes, I suppose, Bulgarian characters, really reflecting the truth of what these people who are, on the one hand, fighting for freedom with a certain idealism, and on the other hand, being pure brigands and looking to some extent for their own profit as well, filled with a sense of mission, of teaching themselves, raising themselves up, all 19th century stuff. And it's written in a very peculiar, part dialect, part antique Bulgarian. And I thought, how can I render this well in English? I thought the only way I could think of doing it is by turning it into dialect. Because these guys come from an area which is very, very rich because of wool, the wool trade. And I, at the moment, live in Essex. I'm sorry to say. London put up all these floods to keep me out. Essex and Suffolk, which, of course, is a big area of the wool trade. And so I thought, can I just give you a small, because I think it's relevant to today, unfortunately. This is my attempt to convey something that one of the lead characters says about washing of hands. They've been royally entertained by some bourgeois, supposedly revolutionary committee members who are far from revolutionary. A little later, the servants bring some chicken stew and red wine and feed us up right proper well. After supper, they bring us bowls of water for us to wash our hands like proper folk do. I do hear recently that some folk have taken to washing their hands afore the meal. That's a step too far, I reckon. They'll be scraping off their skin with so much washing. It's all a la Frenchy, mate, is what I say. If some mad idea fly into your head here in Bulgaria, all you've got to say is it's European. That's what they do in Europe, and everyone's going to believe it, and they start doing it. Why wash, boy, when you're going to be touching meat right away in any case? So you're going to wash again afterwards? Is that right? Well, it's fine for those who has no work to do. And I promise you that's literal word for word translation, except for the boy and the missing G's on the ends of N's. So,
wow. And so now you know why translators really are also creators. This is a very good example of the ear you have to have, the ear you have to have for what you're translating. John worked at the UN International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, and in fact we worked there together. Robert worked there as well, so it's kind of a class reunion, as I just said. And John translated legal texts, evidence, witness statements, in other words, not literature. So my question for John is, can you explain to those of us who are here what the difference is between, let's say, legal translation or evidentiary material and what was referred to as creative writing?
Well, it was brought home to me very firmly by one of our investigators at the tribunal when we were doing a witness statement together, and I was producing this interpretation as we went along, and he said to me, John, we are not working for an Academy Award. And I think one of the extraordinary things about working with so-called small languages, I mean, not many of them are small around here. We've got Turkish, Romanian, and Albanian is 7 million odd.
Hungarian is 7 million.
Yes, there we are. Is that you get to do all sorts of things. And people ask me, you translate Albanian, what do you do? I say, well, novels, war crimes. I have also done artificial insemination of cows. You have to do everything, and this is interesting. You don't get stuck with a specialty, but literary translation. It has to be beautiful. You're aiming at an effect. I think that you're producing an effect in the reader, which you are not when you're translating a legal text. It is meaning, meaning, meaning.
Can I just add to that in a legal environment, you are expected to translate what is said rather than to interpret what was meant, and you let the lawyers fight out what they meant. And for someone who has a creative ear, it is very hard to be literal, which is what you have to be in such an environment, because your instinct is to make it sound good in English. And if ever you read documents from this or any other tribunal, you may well find that the language is very stilted. There's a reason for it.
Can I just come back
on
that one? Because I think the tribunal is a very, very good discipline in this, which can also be transferred into literary translation. That as a literary translation translator too, I feel I must translate and not explain. And there was a wonderful day in court in the tribunal, and somebody stood up and said, "Could the interpreter please explain what is meant by this word?" And the answer came not from the language department or from the interpreter, but from the judge, who said, "The interpreter can be expected to translate, but not to explain." And I think that is holds good for literary translation too.
Well, let's take this one back to poetry. Stephen used a phrase that I read, where he said, "It's not about the words; it's about the shadow of meaning," which I liked very, very much. I'm not sure that applies just to poetry. I would think it applies to literary translation altogether. But I wanted to ask you, Stephen, do you think you have to be a poet to be able to translate poetry?
Can I make a quick comment?
Oh, absolutely. But
it's leading back to your question, you have to be a poet. I did a really interesting project for me about 15 years ago where I was working as a poet in a hospital. And alongside, if you want shadowing, that was a word that we did use, the interpreters in the hospital. Now, the interpreters were meant to translate, but they had to do more than translate. Otherwise, their work was not going to be effective. They had to act as almost sort of community health advocates. So what the judge said to you, if the doctors said to the translators in the hospital, please just translate accurately, a lot would have got lost and people would have died because the interpreters have that. That's why I don't like that. I mean, I hate the word creative writing. I think it's totally meaningless because we're all creative in, or not creative in, every act of our life. Every breath, every walking down the street, every damn thing, I'm sorry. You can see I've got a bias here. I hate the term creative writing. But So do you have to be a poet? Yes and no, because I don't accept that distinction in a way. What on earth is a poet? Who the hell is a poet? You know, I write poetry. Well, okay. I read poetry. You read poetry. I'm sorry. I'm in a way being a tad perverse intentionally because I feel very strongly about these things. I feel very strongly about the role of a poet in any society, and I feel very strongly about the, well, I'll say it again, about stupidity of a lot of poets in thinking they are poets.
Okay.
Well, probably not the answer.
No, all answers are good.
I think it was Joseph Brodsky, I think he said he was proud of being a poet as his profession. He's the only poet.
Okay. But maybe in translating, if you have to use the word poet, then
I guess,
a poet in translating.
Yeah, I was going to get to that. Yeah. One of the joys of translation, I would say, from my point of view anyway, is that you're constantly learning. You're learning your own language. You're learning how far you can stretch it or not. And in that sense, I very well understand what you're saying. Now, there's a question it's bothered me for a long time. Stephen partly mentioned it, and that is, do you translate for the author or the reader? And what I mean by that is, do you so believe in your author that you stay very faithful to that author, stretching your own language in translation as far as it will go, because you so believe in your writer? Or do you say, yeah, but this isn't really going to translate very well. No, I better think about the reader. The reader has to understand the shadow of meaning sometimes. So I'm throwing this question out. I don't think there's an answer. I think it must be individual, not only for the translator, but the writer they do choose to translate. But let me throw it out there. Mevlut.
Well, that reminds me of the story of a blind man and an elephant. When each one of them, when they describe the elephant, they come up with different ideas. Then elephant gets angry. Like, I'm all that, but none. So, now it comes to, what was the question again? I think the translator needs to have a short memory in order to catch that
meanings. Also,
translator, I think, needs to be kind of water. Whichever the cup they go into, takes that shape. So in here is the glass, in the bottle, it's a different shape.
Christopher?
I think you have to have expectations of the reader. Mm. You know, these awful statistics that you mentioned earlier, and of that 0. Whatever percentage of translation, part of it, lots of it will be Stieg Larsson. You know, so in other words, I mean, nothing wrong with Stieg Larsson, but it, you know, popular genre fiction with which readers have become fairly familiar, partly through films and television. But I think you have to expect as a reader who will embark on one of these books here, or a Bulgarian book, will be going with a sense of adventure and wanting to be challenged. And I think that's important. I think also, though, on the other hand, writers that I translate have always been tremendously cooperative. I mean, I cite Alec as an absolute ideal, because he himself understands the importance of writing and rewriting and redoing stuff. But I know, Kapka, you had to translate somebody who absolutely refused to change a single word, even though you know, it led to really unnecessary obscurity. You remember, yeah. So, you know, it's a pleasure and a privilege to work with writers who you can talk to and say, well, you know, could this be better phrased? And of course, that means that the writers have to know your language, of course, or to understand it somewhat.
Yeah. Although this brings to mind Milan Kundera, if I may say so, who is famous for revising translations of his texts in French and in English, they being the two languages that he does. And sometimes it's a complete rewrite. And so, again, what happens when a translator also writes and has a need to rewrite rather than translate what was written, Stephen?
Yeah, and that's a very pertinent for me, but also because I'm working with the poet or a co-translator. I mean, when I work with, say, Anna Jelnica, translating Slovenian poets, which we've done a lot of. Now, Anna grew up partly in Ljubljana, partly in London, so she has a really good grasp of both languages. She insists she is not a poet, and I take her word for it, but maybe she is. Or when I'm working with Claudiu Comartin, a Romanian poet, his English is really fairly good, really pretty good. So we are working together. So we are making the new text together. He's not insistent, but he's very scrupulous. And I think it's important that the person you're working with is very scrupulous. I work with a Syrian poet who's a dear friend of mine, lives in Paris now. Again, we met through friendship at a festival. And his English is astonishingly good. But we just sit, and in all these instances, we are sitting at a table, working from literals, developing them, passing them back and forth, asking questions because you see the words coming from the body of the other person, the poet or co-translator. And that makes a difference because the poem is then literally bodying forth, and you're seeing it, and you're hearing it, and you're therefore asking very slightly different questions, and vice versa. He or Anna will then be saying to me, I've said that, what do you take my meaning to be? Is it that or is it that? So in that sense, this sort of co-translation is really making the poem into a new language together. Apologies, that might not have answered your question.
No. All right. Is there something that could be described as knowing a language too well, John? In other words, you translate from Albanian, and I will assume that your understanding and knowledge of Albanian is such, and everyone here in their respective languages, that you know exactly what is meant by a single word, which means any number of things for the native reader of that text. And now you have to get it into English. Would it maybe be easier if you knew less of that word and therefore were not confined by it, but were freer in interpreting what it might mean in English?
No, I can't see a case for that at all. I think that the more deeply you know a language, the better you become. Maybe if you know a language less well, you feel more confident. But I think that is quite a dangerous sense of confidence. I don't think there is a... I would say no.
All right. Well, where I'm going with this is... There's an article that appeared recently in the New York Review of Books, which is a rather scathing review of a couple that translate from Russian into English. They're quite well known. His name is Richard Pavira. I'm not sure how it's pronounced, but and his wife, Larissa Volokonsky. They have translated Dostoevsky and Tolstoy into English, any number of books. And their approach to translation is quite different from previous translations of Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, in that they believe that previous translations did not pay sufficient attention to exactly the sound, the rhythm, the inversions that existed in the original. And so their attempt is to bring that into English. They have received extremely good reviews, I have to say. In this particular article, and I do recommend that you look it up if you have time, it's by Janet Malcolm. It is a criticism of such an approach. So we're now talking about faithfulness in an extreme sense, in a way. Maybe extreme is not quite...
Are we talking about following grammatic forms?
Also.
Subordinate clauses.
Absolutely.
And word orders.
Absolutely.
That would be extraordinary. In Bulgarian, it would be English.
No, please, go on.
No, is it, well, when I taught in Bulgaria, time of communism, and then the Bulgarian government were very supportive of their writers, which included, I think there was a publication, Sofia Press, which produced English translations of really, really great Bulgarian writers, including some great contemporary writers. What was remarkable about these translations was that they were literal, which also figured typical Bulgarian word order, so that Bulgarians would tend to put a subordinate clause in front of the noun that it agrees with. I'll try to think of an example. The dressed with a bow tie man was standing, rather than the man dressed in the bow tie. This gave the game away immediately that the translator was not an English, was not a native English speaker. You know, it just seemed unnatural. Is that what you're saying is happening here?
Well, I haven't read the translations myself, I don't know, but I think this has a lot to do also with the sound, so not just alliteration, but a kind of rhythm that might be distinctly Russian. We have someone in the audience who knows Russian. Zina, you've read this article.
Yeah, the thing is that this business about word order is ridiculous because Russian is a highly inflected language and English is not. Mm-hmm. You mess around with word order in English, you don't know what you're saying. Yeah. In an inflected language, you can stick anything in any order. You know exactly where you are. Mm-hmm. So I just don't get why they wanted to do that.
And yet, as I say, it's an approach to translation that they defend quite fiercely. and claim that Tolstoy and Dostoevsky sound different, and indeed I have no doubt that they do in these translations.
I think they're interestingly tackling a problem which doesn't often get raised with translating a 19th century text, that often we have new translations of Russian classics saying a Tolstoy for our time, and this is for our time because it comes out in 21st century prose. And whereas the texture of Tolstoy in the original, this is 19th century Russian prose, and it does not sound to me a solution of translating it into a pastiche of 19th century English prose, but these translators are clearly aware of this kind of issue and are trying to do something about it. It would be interesting to see what they do.
There's a quote by Joseph Brodsky regarding Constance Garnett, who translated Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. And basically he said, I think, well, no wonder that English readers don't know the difference between Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, because it's all Constance Garnett. I think maybe that's a very good moment to wind up this conversation. I want to really thank everybody. There'll be questions and answers, of course. I just wanted to say what a pleasure it is to be able to talk shop with people who understand what shop is. It's really been a pleasure. Thank you all so very, very much. And may I quote Stephen, there is really nothing nicer than to be able to be with fellow translators and people who care about literature and translation. So thank you all very, very much. If there are any questions, please feel free to ask. Oh my.
About 20 years ago, I went to an international literary conference in Salzburg. It's actually the only literary conference I've ever been to, but never mind that. And to begin with, there was a South African author there who was talking about a book he had just published and which he said had caused him difficulties until he found it was about, the main character was a seedy journalist. And he had written it in this way and in that way and another way, and it kept going wrong. And finally he said, I discovered that what I hadn't got right was the voice. And once he found the voice of this journalist, away he went. Then out of the audience stepped a serial novelist. And he said, but you see, here we have a problem, because we are not in the Arabic tradition allowed to have a voice. We write in literary, classical Arabic, even if we are writing about now. And when people are meeting on the street, you might be writing them, you know, let's say they're two muggers, talking to each other in muggery language, bruv, but not in the Arabic. In that other, in the Arabic, it would come out as, if you translated it into English, as prithee, hail my friend, and so on. Is that something that has happened in any of the languages that you work from, where the initial language, the register of it, is so different that you're either going to be faithful to the author in the way that the author's culture expects when they're writing for their own language, or are you doing a total transposition?
In Bulgarian, I think conversations on street level are very similar to ones in English. I am translating a magic realist book at the moment, there the language is extremely heightened, and the characters are almost mythological. And then, you know, you can do what you like with that. You know, you can have as many prithees, although I haven't used the word prithee.
But Bulgarian allows you to do both.
Yes.
Whereas the Arabic tradition apparently doesn't, and there's the difficulty.
No, I haven't had.
Can I ask, because I know that you're the translator,
yeah.
I think I know what you mean. Yeah. Are you finding yourself wanting to tone down some of the language or some of the...
No, I'm trying to stay faithful to it, because it's the only way it's going to work, I think, because it is magic.
Just a comment on what you said, but for instance, a lot of the contemporary poets in Egypt, even some of the older ones, but a lot of the younger ones are rapping in non-classical So I take the point you're making, but there are many writers who've tried to break away from that.
Well, this was 20
it
years
it remains
ago,
a problem in translating novels written in that way, for sure. But
I'm not asking if you think certain languages have affinities for each other. The first Greek, modern Greek novel I read in way back in 1961 by Cousin Sarkis, I read in French translation. And then I later read Cabaret in also in French translation. And probably in between the two, I read Moravia, Italian, in Greek translation. They all made, these translations made a tremendous impression on me. And I sometimes wonder whether it's because actually these languages somehow, I know they're different branches of the Indo-European language, that they had some kind of closer affinity than English has, and that perhaps, you know, that does make a difference. Or perhaps it was the societies had at least, were still in some extent peasant societies, and so there was a kind of more culturally in common in those novels. I also thought maybe it was an linguistic thing.
Mm. John,
Spirit? I think the definitely that's affinity is there, but I think this our society now has changed so much. I see that that is exists more of the European languages. You enjoy, for example, if you are an English speaker, at the same time you can enjoy the same text in French or German. But if you are dealing with the other than European languages, like Turkish, you have to be very careful because you are entering another domain, another language. So I think depending on the, how the translator interpret that text in another language, you see, that the taste, I think it, that is a distinction is there, that because you are dealing with the in a way German, French, English, more or less the same world. So
no, for me I don't think it is the same, but I think maybe
to me anyway, the way
Anglo-Saxon
yeah.
languages would translate, or Scandinavian languages might have more affinity and translate between each other more easily, and then there's a kind of Mediterranean set of languages
yeah.
which
it is
maybe
that,
translate.
Yeah. But much easier than Turkish, that's what I mean, that they're transferring the meaning.
How about languages that we're talking about here? Let's say Turkish, Albanian, Turkish, Bulgarian, Slovene, Romanian. Do you?
Because I think with the Turkish being there, I think that 10,000 words in the Balkan countries, and more or less 9,000-10,000 words. So there are common words and the common culture is there. There are, of course, differences there, but at the same time, it's molded.
Mm.
Yes.
Thank you for this wonderful discussion. It was really passionate. I want to ask you, do you consider it's a chance when you, any one of you, do you consider it's a chance when you have to translate a contemporary author because you may ask questions, or in the contrary, because they have some ideas? You know, I translated Milan Kundera from French to Romanian. I was so afraid because I heard he's awful as an author who wants to be translated. So have you troubles with contemporary authors? Do you ask questions to these authors when you translate?
I think what is important is with a living author is building a relationship of trust. And in my experience, if you ask stupid questions, this erodes the trust. So my first port of call with my stupid questions is another native speaker. And I store up for the author really quite sophisticated questions, and these show that I am paying attention and are aware of issues. And this, I think builds trust with your person. That is quite
fun. About?
I think with the living writers, it's a chance. It's nice to have a second opinion, but sometimes I think the way they interpret doesn't always it work in another language. You see, that is the problem. Because in the case of Turkish, for example, they know English probably, they know what it means through the lexicon. Okay, that doesn't mean that. No, that's what you meant.
Yeah.
You see what I mean? That is the problem. It can be a problem.
There are ambiguities, aren't there,
yeah,
which you do want to clear up.
Yeah.
I've had nothing but really good cooperation with the writers that I write with.
Can I just add, I must say I share John's approach. I translate from Serbo-Croat, and I've been very lucky to have translated living authors. However, there is quite a well-known story of a writer whose book I was translating, and he had a bird in it. And I couldn't figure out what bird this was. And I couldn't find it anywhere in the dictionary, so I started asking friends, native speakers. And one said, it's a crow. No, no. And I said, blackbird. No, no, it's a raven. Well, it was black. But I still couldn't get it. It was quite important. And I thought, how odd. They're so adamant that they know what the name of the bird is. So I did go to the author in the end. And I said, but what is this bird? And he said, I made it up. So much for asking native speakers, my point. Anyway, any other questions?
Thank you. If I can, as this wonderful panel, if I can ask a couple of points. Firstly, if I can turn back on John, the question he asked a little earlier, before lunch, about, I'm thinking of Kadarek, there is the Fire on Age, the Wedding Guests are Frozen, which very heavily reflect in their structure parts of Albanian mythology that any Albanian knows from the moment they're born. This, of course, is completely foreign to anybody who's not from the region. And how do you get that across? My second point, is what you said about translation for today. The only translation I've ever done is academic work. And one of the things I find is, you mentioned dictionaries, one with Albanian is the dictionary is an incredibly frustrating place to be, because the emphasis on so much of Albanian lexicography is to excise words rather than to keep them in. And secondly, the terminology is often in the middle of being changed or just doesn't exist yet. One of the things that we've all been through is the end of communism. And how do you cope with the change in language during that time? How do you keep afresh with the language? Talking about rapping, for example. And the third thing is to turn back what was said earlier about the voice and about antiquity. Does this film, not work the other way, that, say, a 19th century English character, because of the way that the Turkish language sort of was created anew, does that not deny that character a voice?
um, I think the point about creating the language anew is very interesting, because this is why Albanian is so interesting, because it is under perpetual change and renewal, and Ismail Kadare indeed is quite idiosyncratic bringing in language innovation, is trying to introduce new words into the language, and is trying to purify the style. And it is in fact not a straightforward, natural, everyday prose style, such as the other writer I translate, Fatos Lobonia, such as he would write. It is quite idiosyncratic, and I was quite pleased when one of the newspapers reviewed one of my translations and said, "This is pleasantly odd." And it is. In the original, it is actually quite odd. I thought that had gone well. the mythological dimension is... I think myths often look like myths, and they have a slightly universal quality. They are archetypal, and although they're distinctively Albanian, they go wider than that. I mean, there's the famous Albanian myth, which is the story of the three-arched bridge, about somebody who is immured is a sacrifice into a bridge that's being built, and that's in Bosnia too.
In Bulgaria.
Yeah. And in Bulgaria too.
I
have also discovered that it's in London, and it's an urban myth that in London East End gangs had put one of their victims into the concrete of the Hammersmith flyover. And I thought this was just quite amazing, but this is in fact a universal myth. Yes, where was I? I think there was another question, wasn't there another one?
It was something about changing language, wasn't there?
I thought I dealt with that one.
There's a wonderful word which is almost untranslatable in Bulgarian. It's chalga. Okay, somebody laughed. it is very difficult to translate, because if you say the word chalga to a Bulgarian, they will immediately lift their nose up in the air, and as if there's some bad smell around. But it is it means a form of pop music which I think originates in Yugoslavia.
In Serbia.
has Turkish and gypsy rhythms, and has quite sexist texts, which are not totally dissimilar to rap. And I listen to this in my car in Bulgaria, but I would be ashamed to admit it to other people. And this, talking about the way language changes, I mean, I've been recently translating some classic Bulgarian poetry, and there the language, I've met 19th century Bulgarian poetry goes quite well with 19th century English poetry. You know, if you can try and create the rhymes and the rhythms and the general feel for the language, it works quite well. But equally, translating modern Bulgarian poetry, you're going for the more sort of the hard-hitting rap-type stuff. Yeah. So, languages are developing all the time. And, of course, English is developing. I mean, English is a multinational language now. We borrow words from here, there and everywhere, which helps the translator, particularly when they're translating something modern.
Can I add on to that? Excuse me. Just one thing. Albert Camus has his book, which was called A Stranger When I Was Going to School. I think it's now called The Outsider, right? L'étranger. And the opening line is a very, very well-known line, which is, "Mother died today." Well, the book has been retranslated, and it has been retranslated to start with "Maman died today," very much because it is assumed that today's reader of someone like Camus will know that "Maman" is mother. And mother is not quite "Maman," by the way. It's "Mommy" or "Mom," but you wouldn't say "Mom died today." I mean, that wouldn't really be a memorable line. So just to say in support of how English is changing, how the English reader is becoming much more international. Stephen, I'm sorry, you were going to say something.
No, in a way I was thinking about a lot of things that have been said. And I suppose I just wanted to say, isn't English here to be changed and to be changed by translation,
yeah.
At least up to a point?
Yeah.
Otherwise it just dies away. Which is a good, maybe an apt thing to say today.
I was thinking about the image that you had. Can you? I'd like you to repeat it. The thing about the eye.
Yes, in the eye.
You're entering my eye.
You're entering my eye. I think it'd be possible for an English translator to put in a context of a particular kind of novel to use that phrase and do exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Introducing a new way of seeing things, which is what translation of foreign literature is all about, really.
And also, can I about the language experience within, especially with the Turkish case? Turkey had the alphabet changed, Latinized in the early 20s, so that meant probably the only in the world, only country, cut its tie with the past.
Mm-hmm.
Then. When you look at the early days of the literary work produced, the quality is very poor. It took Turkey almost 800 years now. It's kind of coming back to the fore. So even now, new generations won't understand 19th century text, even early 20th century text. So I think that's a different experience with the Turkish case. And yes. Then again, even if I translate the text, older text, kind of use the modernize it, because the new audience won't understand that. Doesn't make sense to the new audience because time has changed, the language is different, and probably here and there try to introduce new words. For example, instead of saying darling, you just say beloved. That sort of thing is, you know, very minute introductions to the language.
Keeping with the theme here, basically, about different eras and things like that, one thing that I've noticed when I've watched films and reading books as well from the Balkan region is that since the formation of standardized languages is something of a new phenomenon, I always find it rather a knowing experience of having listened to the way, say, for instance, the people of my grandparents' generation, the way that they speak their language. They're totally different, with a lot more, especially the Balkans, a lot more Turkish words that you use now than younger people use. So whenever you see something like a historic film from Bulgaria or ex-Yugoslavia, and that's set in a rural setting, and they're speaking in this standardized form, it's just like, this is wrong, you know, because they weren't speaking like that.
That's
so
right.
How do you tackle a situation like that properly? Would you still stick with the standardized language, or would you try and bring in elements of the way that they spoke at that time to fit?
I think I would keep that because that enriches the language, you see, keep that dialect as well.
Mm. Well, that's very much to the point what I was saying about my translation of Milan Rusko.
Mm.
But also, I mean, Bulgaria. I'm always kind of reluctant as an English person to say anything about Bulgaria because I realise Bulgarians can feel quite sensitive about foreigners saying things about Bulgaria. But Bulgarians will say themselves, which is my get-out, that Bulgaria is like a small village. You know, everybody knows each other. It's one of the interesting aspects of Bulgarian politics that everybody knows each other. Everybody knows whose son they are, whose daughter they are, whose granddaughter they are, whose grandson they are. Say, oh, what, him? Don't you realise that he is X, Y, and Z? And which some of the greatest Bulgarian classic writing obviously takes place in villages. I mean, wonderful, wonderful short stories. And translating Elin Pelin or Yovkov, I will try to use a kind of, not dialect exactly, but an appropriate language for village life. Yeah, peasant. Well, peasant is not an English concept, but yeah.
Ask the question slightly differently for me to answer that. I don't know.
Are myths and archetypes common?
Are you want to say that if everyone has all the stories,
right,
do we need new stories?
The same
concept.
Well, for instance, I want to translate Tretiko Kosovel, and he's now been translated quite widely, so I maybe won't. Slovenian poet who died very young, because I don't know any poet in English who writes like him, and I could say that of a number of other poets. For me, that's really important. Yes, those archetypes and mythologies are and are not shared, and are fragmented, and are lost, and are buried, and are rising in us, or are flooding us, or are not, or whatever. But there are poets and writers who haven't written like anybody else I know in English. And I do want English to be changed, because otherwise my language just shrivels up and dies if it keeps away what is not already within it.
I think that works the other way too. So by translating and talking to writers, the whole experience gets enriched. And I don't know, yes, you can sort of see every story in the every story. So, somebody's done this, haven't they? They've categorized. There are seven basic stories in the whole of world literature. However, the computer variations on these seven basic stories are so wonderful and marvelous. And when you look at these seven stories as they are told in other cultures with different meanings, then suddenly new possibilities open up. And it's particularly sort of living between cultures and living between languages, sensing the shadow of meaning, that things get really, really exciting, I think.
I'm not conscious ever of encountering an experience in another language which is inaccessible. I think it was called the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis,
mm-hmm.
which was that our languages, in fact, govern our perceptions, that our languages decide for us what we perceive. And this immediately starts making translation extremely difficult. And I think it was based on American Indian, Native American languages. For instance, in Navajo, people go backwards into the future, because on the grounds that the past, they can see the past, so that it's in front of them,
whereas the future is unknown, so it's considered as behind them. I mean, this country is getting a bit Navajo. I think there is a universality that we can, I hope, take for granted.
Can we just add one thing? David Bellos is a translator who, until John and Robert came along, translated Cadere from the French translation, not directly from Albanian. He did wonderful translations, that's not the issue. He has written a book called There's a Fish in My Ear. Excellent book. It will address, in a wonderfully witty way, many aspects of translation. In this book, he says that while literary translators in the Anglo-Saxon world had better keep their day jobs because they sure as hell aren't going to be able to support themselves with the money they earn from literary translation, in Japan, translators are perceived, treated, and respected the same way as authors and novelists are here. I think you now know why. So that's my last word.
Thank you very, very much, Christina. And.